We're going to start today with a public hearing on House Bill 2449. House Bill 2449. So I'll open that public hearing. Council, if you want to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2449 increases the civil penalties for abuse of elderly or incapacitated persons to 3 times the amount of the actual economic or non-economic damages incurred. Proponents of this measure state that abuse of elderly incapacitated persons is an increasing problem, especially given the large number of persons residing in assisted living facilities, and this measure would further discourage such abuse and encourage prosecution.
And Representative Haas, are you here on that bill?
Yes.
And is Senator Ringo here on that bill as well?
Yes. Yep.
Mr. Chair, I am here on the bill, and I just encourage your support, but I do have to go to another committee.
All right.
I won't testify.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. We would have been happy to accommodate you. Representative Haas, why don't you go ahead and come forward? Do you have somebody you want to bring with you?
Yes, I'd like to, if I could have joined me, Virginia Mitchell and Ken Russer. Come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Committee. Mark Haas, House District 27. I'm very grateful for you taking action and hearing this bill today. There are people far more knowledgeable on this subject than me, and people with far more compelling stories on why this bill is needed. So I won't go through any formal testimony of myself, but I do want to introduce Ken Russer. He is one of the state's most decorated war heroes from Beaverton, and Virginia Mitchell, who is an attorney who defends seniors who have become victims of financial fraud or elder abuse. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Colonel Risser.
Welcome, Colonel.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, and I hope that this bill can pass and will be of benefit to people that experience something like I'm going to tell you my story about. There's a lot of crime out there and a lot of people preying on the elderly and disabled, and I know you know that. So my story is, I'm an Oregonian, and I was born in 1920 in Tillamook County, and went to Oregon State, and when the World War II started, I'd flown some in a government program, so I was cinched to get right into the aviation area. I ended up in the Marine Corps and served for about 28 years, and I was active in combat in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. Now, I always considered myself pretty lucky. I'd been a lot of places and come through all right. I got out of the military and spent a few years in Washington, D.C. with a consulting company. Then I retired and come back to my home state of Oregon as a final retirement. And I built a house up on top of Mount Hebo in Tigard, and the old road 175 that went up over the hill there has been known for many, many years as Ricer Road. So I had a lot of ties, and I wanted to come back to Oregon, and I did that. I built a house and was all settled in for retirement. Then two things happened to me. One was this disaster of the 11th September, and I had some investments that didn't do very good. I had to struggle and try to get my house in order, and I would have made it, except my wife had poor health and wanted some help doing the paperwork. And ended up, she hired a company, R.T. Thomas & Associates. Thomas worked for us for over 2.5 years before we found out that he was happily embezzling our money. Very clever about it. He was also professed to be a computer mechanic, and he really was. Well, when I found out about this, as I said, I thought I could recover from the stock loss, but this kind of tipped the things the other way. And if it hadn't been for Washington County Services for the aging and veterans, they helped me keep my balance and helped me get started on this. But my losses amounted to much that they're now foreclosing on my home. And I wouldn't know which way to turn if it wasn't for these people, and I hope very much that this bill goes through and can help with that. Now, I think my story is to be told better than I can by reading a recent article that was put out by the Oregonian, and I think some copies have been provided for you. I have a few more, and I'll stick them on the table as I leave if there isn't enough to go around. But I appreciate what you're all doing for us.
Thank you, Colonel. We appreciate your coming here today and sharing with us your story. Ms. Mitchell?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the Judiciary Committee. I'm honored and pleased to appear before you today regarding House Bill 2449 and to share with you my experiences as an attorney representing the elderly and their estates. First, I would like to thank Representative Mark Haas for bringing this to the attention of the committee and the legislature and for his efforts. Perhaps a little of my background is in order. I have been practicing almost 20 years as an attorney. I am licensed in Oregon, California, and in Arizona. My practice of law started when I worked for two federal judges, and then I went to work as a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County prosecuting criminal cases. Thereafter, I was an in-house corporate counsel for a national video retail franchisor, and then I started my private practice in 1989 in Beaverton, Washington County, representing primarily in estate planning and the elderly and also small and medium-sized businesses. I'd like to talk to you about my experience as an attorney representing the elderly and handling their estates, as well as the experience of fellow attorneys in the field and the judges in Washington County who I did speak to in preparation for this hearing today. As I sit here before you, I'm reminded of a quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes, The Common Law, 1881, wherein he states, "The life of the law has not been logic. It has been experience." And it is experience that brings all of us here today before you. I spoke with Judge Lund, who recently retired from Washington County as a circuit court judge who was handling probate cases and elderly fraud cases, as well as Judge Cobb. There, in talking to me, they stated that 10 years ago, they never saw cases of fraud against the elderly. Then a few years ago, they started to see some. And today, it is so frequent, it doesn't surprise them. That also has been my experience in the practice. In just the last 3 years in my office, I would say it has increased fivefold. The reasons, I believe, will be explained later. I believe, as Judge Cobb believes, that we are seeing the tip of the iceberg. We feel that there are probably a lot of other fraud cases that are undiscovered, or perhaps those elderly who have been defrauded are ashamed to come forward. My experience matches that of the courts and it also of my fellow attorneys. So why should House Bill 2449 deter or prevent fraud or give justice to the elderly? Perhaps the best example that I can give you were two cases that I was handling simultaneously from 2000 to 2002. I represented an elderly lady, I'll call her Mrs. Smith, for approximately 10 years prior to her death. And she was everything I wanted to be when I am in my 80s and my 90s. She was brave because she was a widow with no children living alone. She was intelligent, beautiful shock of white hair and beautiful blue eyes. And even though she was alone, she continued to travel around the world. And when she turned 88, she decided after being a lifelong Oregonian that she really needed to warm her bones in the desert of Arizona and moved there. I continued to represent her because, of course, I'm licensed there, and she was delighted to not have to, in addition to change all other professionals, but then change lawyers. Unfortunately, she had met a financial planner here in Oregon who also subsequently moved to Arizona, who gained a great deal of her confidence. towards the last year and a half to 2 years of her life, she became less and less able to handle her own financial affairs and depended upon him. As a financial planner, she had approximately $600,000 of an estate, and when he saw that she was deteriorating and possibly might pass, there were two annuities that he transferred into both his name and hers as an initial step, and I believe with the end result of transferring it ultimately into his own name. She passed away prior to being able to cash those checks that he could have as her financial planner, and he proceeded to say that those $250,000 were a gift for all of the services he had rendered and for friendship, as well as he stated that there was another additional $60,000 for actual wages that he had earned in writing checks and so forth. I proceeded to do an investigation by talking to distant family members who were living in, I believe, New Mexico, as well as neighbors, and of course knowing full well her estate plan, which was, because she had no children, it was to give all of it to charity, to children's homes. And I knew full well that giving a gift of $250,000 was not her plan, particularly since it had happened the last 30 days of her life, that this transaction had happened. I then proceeded to do some research into the Arizona statute, which, as you know, provides for treble damages. At that point, I wrote a letter to this financial planner informing him of the statute and what I was going to do. He subsequently hired an attorney, and I again said, I am going to go after you for what you stole, three times what you stole, attorney's fees and costs, and believe me, I will do it because I am licensed there. Needless to say, in 3 months, the $250,000 was returned, the entirety of it. The $60,000 claim for these services rendered, he decided not to proceed with. We never filed a civil action in Arizona, a probate one, all of her assets were in trust, or a civil complaint. My attorney's fees totaled $2,320, and the costs were $3.76. Some of that was in discussions with the attorney, the gentleman prior to his representation letters, and then, of course, getting the annuities properly transferred into the trust. I contrast that with a case that I was handling in Oregon at the same time. We will call this client Mrs. Johnson. I never had the privilege of knowing Mrs. Johnson. I only had the privilege of knowing her nieces and nephews. They came to see me upon her death because they had suspected that under a power of attorney, the nephew had stolen $160,000 of this woman's estate over the last 3 years of her life. They also knew that he had done the very same thing with their grandmother, and they were not going to let it happen again. At that point in time, of course, I wanted to settle the case before trying to file an action because litigation is expensive. So I proceeded to try to negotiate with this case in beginning October of 2000, asking for an accounting and so forth, an informal accounting, not through the courts. Initially, he stated he had no money. And then once I became involved, there was $50,000. Oh, and then there was another $20,000. Then there was another $20,000. I could not get, it was a little bit like shooting a moving target, I couldn't get a straight answer from this man, and every time he came up, every time we basically pierced his story to show it was false, he came up with another accounting. He was represented by an attorney, and we proceeded to file a probate action in Multnomah County, and then we had to file a civil action for fraud, conversion, and financial abuse of the elderly. We proceeded with that case, making discovery requests for productions and so forth, subpoena duces tecum to establish that this fraud has taken place. We were able to recover of what we felt was approximately $160,000 that was stolen, $108,000. After my attorney's fees, not I should say before, my attorney's fees of $15,500 and costs of $1,111 to proceed through all of this. We had to file two court cases in Multnomah County because one is the probate and they cannot handle the fraud action in the probate court. We took court time, we took staff time, and of course the expense, and of course we did not recover all of the money for the estate or the attorney's fees or the costs. So those are two very dramatic examples of how I had in the Arizona case what I would call a club that I could threaten, truly threaten this individual with, which was treble damages. I have spoken with colleagues in Arizona who also practice in the estate planning and litigation arena, and they have told me in most cases that threat is a genuine one, and what happens is those individuals return the money without having to resort to the courts. One of your questions may be, why wouldn't punitive damages work in this type of a case? Well, in fact, I did put in my complaint a request for punitive damages. As you know, here in Oregon, we have to request of the judge to ask for punitive damages. But our fear as attorneys is that, first of all, of course, it comes too late. It comes at the conclusion of the legal process. It requires a trial. It requires a jury. It requires judicial resources. Furthermore, we as attorneys are concerned that there is this pot of money that juries are going to give to the elderly as compensation for what they've suffered. But what juries don't know is in punitive damage, with punitive damages, the victim will only get 20%. Another 20% goes to the attorney, and then 60% goes to the victim's compensation fund for criminal victims. So it really isn't a useful threat or a useful club. As you know, as part of the Financial Abuse of the Elderly Act, we, as attorneys, when we file an action, also have to file a complaint with the Attorney General's office. But due to the budgetary constraints, they do not have the time to prosecute these cases. That's why more of a private right of action threat is necessary. So why should we pass this bill? Basically, five reasons. First, we have a growing elderly population, what we call the graying of America. In 1900, we had 3 million senior citizens. In the year 2000, we have 35 million senior citizens. The statistics show that the senior citizen population will soon outnumber any other individual age group because they are the fastest growing age group. According to Lincoln Financial Distributors, Inc., a February 4, 2003 article, by the year 2052, there will be 76 million senior citizens. Secondly, senior citizens are more likely to be victims of fraud because they have a nest egg. They're more likely to own a home, as my gentleman beside me has stated, have savings, and have a nest egg. Number three, the greatest transfer of wealth is occurring in this country and in the world today from one generation to the next. According to A.G. Edwards, from 1997 through 2007, there will be $4 trillion that will pass from one generation to the next. And again, pursuant to Lincoln Financial Distributors, Inc., by the year 2052, $40.6 trillion will be transferred from one generation to the next. The fourth reason that we need this bill to pass: those who grew up in the 30s and the 40s and even in the 50s were generally raised with the idea to be polite and trusting, and therefore they're more likely to be victims. Pursuant to a congressional statement by Dennis Lormel, Chief Financial Crime Section for the Federal Bureau of Investigation on Fraud Against the Elderly, before the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging in Washington, D.C., September 10, 2001, he was reporting to them these very statistics and the fact that this generation is so very vulnerable based on their trust. Number five, why we need the passage of this bill. The elderly are less likely to report the fraud. First, they don't know who to report to. Second, they are also, sometimes they're ashamed and embarrassed. Judge Cobb was telling me about an elderly man with steely gray eyes that was before her where apparently family members in the state had gotten involved in a conservatorship because he had been defrauded. And at the end of all of the testimony, hearing everyone talk about how he had been defrauded, he stated, "Well, I guess everyone's right. I'm just a useless old fool." So it's not just the financial effects that are devastating, but it's the emotional and psychological ones as well. Also, why they're less likely to report the fraud is many times competency issues are involved. They don't realize that they've been defrauded, and even once they pass away, their family members may not be intricately familiar with their finances and don't know that a fraud has occurred. In conclusion, I guess perhaps not to make light, but perhaps maybe for all of us to realize the importance of this bill, is a quotation by Charles Kettering. "We should all be concerned about the future. We will all have to spend the rest of our lives there." I would like to thank you again for allowing me to share my experiences with you, and I would be more than happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Let's open it up, committee, to any questions for the panel. I recognize Representative Hass, you probably have other legislative business you need to get to. We appreciate you staying through the duration of the testimony. Are there questions for the panel? Okay, good. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony very much. Next, I'd like to call, again, in a panel of three, although I know you all signed up individually, Stephen Schneider, Jim Davis, and Grady Tarbutton, and I may be... Tarbutton, okay, all right. Yeah, if you want to come up, and then also Jim and Steve Schneider. And I'd encourage the panel to be concise. I think we understand what the bill does. Feel free to proceed. Do you want to start, Mr. Schneider?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stephen Schneider. I'm the Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Kulongoski and previously served at the Department of Human Services as a criminal justice liaison for senior services, and I also was Assistant Attorney General in the Consumer Protection Division. I'm here today representing the governor who stands in support of House Bill 2449. Just in terms of a quick education, in the mid-1990s, then Attorney General Kulongoski started the first statewide task force on elder abuse to start a coordination between law enforcement and social service advocates. Prior to the inception of that task force, there was little coordination at the statewide level, and we were successful in terms of moving through a number of key pieces of legislation, working with the law enforcement community, the financial institution community, and others, and that has migrated to creating multidisciplinary teams in basically all 36 counties. And for several years after that, I was the person staffing not only the task force but also the work that we were doing at the community level. The speakers have spoken before myself about the elders, the elder community not only growing but being highly vulnerable. The work that I've done as Assistant Attorney General and also in the task force, we've seen there are individuals and corporations that intentionally target seniors because of their age, perceived infirmity, their trustworthiness, and also their key assets. It doesn't surprise any of us that there are a number of cases out there that we can point to. There was a mother whose son had just returned from the penitentiary and started ripping off his mother to the point that the utility shutoff notices came through of several thousand dollars in arrears. A Roseburg woman who was defrauded of $700,000 by two caregivers. A couple that went door to door and intentionally targeted families that had a member of the family that had Alzheimer's and would sell vacuum cleaners for several thousand dollars. So the cases are pretty stark out there that there are very vulnerable people that are intentionally targeted because of their age. I think the previous speaker talked about the hammer that this bill brings in terms of providing treble damages, and clearly we think that's the right thing to do. The governor also believes and understands that once you start losing money for people that are of older age, health usually declines thereafter. So the treble damages in some ways helps the victim become partially whole, if not whole. You'll see an increase in suicide, increase in declining health, falls, so on and so forth. The only issue I'd like to bring up regarding this bill, and I hate to throw a monkey wrench in, but the only issue I'd like to bring up is the fact that when you look at the statewide numbers regarding the number of cases that come through the Department of Human Services, in the year 2002, we had a little over 1,000 financial exploitation cases. Approximately 50% of those are considered substantiated. Far and away, the leading elder abuse category that we see is neglect. Neglect is not part of this bill. And at some point, I think it would be a good thing for us to discuss why neglect is not part of that, as we are taking into consideration financial exploitation and physical abuse. Neglect is a very, very serious issue amongst those advocates in the elder abuse community, oftentimes leading towards death. And so I would just urge the committee at some point to look at that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. Mr. Davis.
Yes. I'm Jim Davis, representing United Seniors of Oregon, Alzheimer's Association of Oregon, Greater Idaho, and the Portland Grey Panthers. We're here today to express our strong support for House Bill 2449. It's a good piece of legislation that will provide more realistic penalties to address and combat the serious problem of financial exploitation of seniors and people with disabilities. This type of abuse is one of the most commonly referred problems of elder abuse in our senior and disability service system. As this type of senior crime increases, there is greater and greater financial loss to the victims of these elder crimes, as you've heard today in testimony. Victims can lose thousands of dollars, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars. And a lot of the criminal offenders, who can be both family members and strangers and or strangers, are defrauding seniors and people with disabilities of millions of dollars before they're being caught. Seniors and people with disabilities are usually in no position to replace the money or the resources they've lost in these fraudulent situations. Most can't work. They're often left to ask for public assistance simply to survive. As a representative of the Alzheimer's Association, too, I might just add that people with dementia and families who are dealing with that problem are particularly vulnerable in these situations. As senior population grows by leaps and bounds, we can only see this kind of fraudulent difficulty continuing and creating even a greater hardship for these populations. There needs to be stronger penalties in statute to fight this serious crime against seniors. We urge your support of House Bill 2449. And we would also agree that if you amended this to include neglect, we would certainly be supportive of that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Davis. I'm going to get it wrong again. Is it Tarbutton?
Tarbutton. That's very close.
All right, good.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Grady Tarbutton. I work with the Washington County Department of Aging and Veterans Services. We're also members of the Washington County Elder Abuse Multidisciplinary Team. And the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities is also in support of this bill. I've been working in aging services since 1976 in Washington, Kansas, as well as Oregon, and elder abuse has always been one of my areas of concern. And frequently there's a lack of legislation that supports protection of elders, unlike with children. In spite of that fact, the department, Washington County Department of Aging and Veterans Services, gets 50 cases of elder abuse reported each month. And half of those are financial exploitation. About 70 of those cases get referred each year to the Washington County District Attorney for prosecution. Again, half of those are financial exploitation. As you can see, there's quite a gap between the number of complaints that we actually receive and the number of complaints that are prosecuted. So there remain quite a few elderly and their families that are looking for some other recourse to deal with financial exploitation. Some of it is serious. Certainly its impacts are serious, as have been previously mentioned. Little is often recovered also in these cases. This bill, we believe, would have some very positive impact upon this situation. First of all, it would act as a deterrent of crime. Not only can attorneys use it to leverage or hammer the perpetrator, making the community aware of it can also deter the crime. Prosecutions are deterring a crime. I might mention between 1993 and 1999, there were only two cases that were referred to the Washington County District Attorney. This last year, as I said, there were 70. We're going to see a continuing growth of that, but it's telling you that there's a really uncovered problem within the community that is just beginning to be addressed by the community. This law will help us do that. This law will also give the families, as I mentioned, their guardians, a civil remedy when a criminal prosecution is not an option. Frequently, criminal prosecution requires such a high standard that and these cases can be so difficult to investigate that it never does reach the courts. So a civil penalty would be, a civil option would be a benefit as well. Finally, next, the increased public awareness of elder abuse crimes. Our department and the other members of the elder abuse multidisciplinary team make sure that prosecutions are published in the paper throughout Washington County. We want to build more and more awareness, and we would certainly make sure that this law was advertised or promoted within the community. And finally, this bill would reduce the number of people impoverished by financial exploitation. There's a document published by Leslie Wilson for a master's degree at the University of Oregon, published in 2001 with the support of State Department on Aging, called Financial Exploitation in Oregon Senior Disabled Community. She noted that a high percentage of the people that were victims of financial exploitation ended up on Medicaid. So in one way or another, the state, the taxpayer, helps pay for the care of these folks who have become ill or are have become more ill as a result of the crime perpetrated against them. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Tarbutton. Okay, questions of the panel? Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just comment on Mr. Schneider about the expanding abuse to neglect. We can look at that. This bill amends ORS 124-100. The next statute in the sequence that's not amended by this bill does define the abuse that for which an action can be brought under this statute, and includes assault, menacing, recklessly endangering, criminal mistreatment, rape, sodomy, unlawful sexual penetration, sexual abuse, and action, let's see, for physical constraints or subjecting plaintiff to prolonged or continued deprivation of food or water, and some other. So, you know, it may be worth looking at that statute to see if that's the statute that might need to be amended, or maybe not, depending on what's in there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, I don't have the statute in front of me, but the issue of neglect would go beyond the withdrawal of food and water. It could also go to the issue of over or under medication as well. And so I think we'd have to look at the statute more specifically. But just in the course of all of our work and the work at the DHS, Seniors and People with Disabilities, neglect is a very, very real issue. Oftentimes it's intentional, oftentimes it's unintentional. Be that as it may, I think we would be doing a disservice to vulnerable elders out there if we didn't include it.
I just want to point out that would be the statute we would amend if we wanted
right.
to expand.
Yeah, not the one that's...
Yeah.
Okay, good. Any further questions? Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Snyder, I want to follow up on Representative Shetterly's brought up regarding neglect. I know one of the cases I reviewed for Florence was a case where a person was involved in elder care with one of the care-providing homes, and your office, based on the reports and stuff, we just didn't think we had enough to go forward with a prosecution, and it was neglect, basically dealing with failure to provide the care that she had, that should have been provided to her, and changing bedding, rotating her position and stuff like that were sourced. So if we were going to look at trying to include that, I guess one question I would have you, or maybe if the prosecutor from Washington County have looked at what's happening in other states regarding that area of neglect and providing for civil remedy as compared to just relying on criminal prosecution.
I have not looked at any of the statutes in other states, but it's something we can look into fairly quickly.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, I have not looked at that either. It doesn't surprise me that the case may not have gone to prosecution. One of the issues that we've had to deal with for it's been about 7 or 8 years is actually working with the law enforcement community to not only teach them how to investigate certain cases, but also their willingness to prosecute. As you can expect, in some ways, like child abuse cases, you don't necessarily have an unwilling victim. Sometimes you do in these cases, but you may not have a victim that is going to be a good witness because of dementia or other issues. And then you get into the family dynamics of them not wanting to testify against a caregiver.
The issue we had, because I reviewed the case, we're ready to go. I had three officers at warning were begging that we went forward. We just did not have anyone that we could pin that on to as to being the offender. And so it would seem to me that if we have individuals in these care providing facilities, that maybe we want to make certain we capture the facility can also be held accountable and not just the individual employee of those establishments.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe facilities as they are described in the chapter are immune from this law.
Well, that's something that we maybe want to look at.
It may be. I think it may make the bill sledding a bit harder, given. And I'm just being real honest. Right. I think we've got a bill that is narrowly targeting a tool that's going to work good. That I don't think has a lot of opposition. I think if we do a lot in the way of expansion, we lessen the chances of this bill broadly being successful when it moves over to the Senate side. So, with that in mind, I'm happy to engage in a longer discussion about elder abuse stuff, which I think is a really important thing for this committee to do. But I also feel like we want to make sure that this bill has the ability to move with a certain degree of swiftness, targeting exactly what it's targeting, based on the testimony we heard, which was that even the threat of the treble damages is going to drive some of these people to give up their ill-gotten gains and not go through the process of having to stare down the barrel of that damage amount. And I think that's, in my mind, the real value to making this move.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative.
Yeah, my comments are really just to, elaborate on what Mr. Snyder said, is maybe at some point in the future we should be looking at this. And I just want that on the record. I agree. The bill we have before us, we should not hinder it because it will, in fact, accomplish what we've already heard. Right. But we should be looking at a broader perspective where we're going to look at neglect.
Okay. Anything else for this panel? Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
Okay, closing the public hearing then on House Bill 2449. Going to open a work session on House Bill 2449.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I would move House Bill 2449 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves that we send House Bill 2449 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the part of the committee? No? Okay. All right. Excuse me? No, I don't think so. All right. Then let's go ahead, Nancy.
Can I come in?
Bob.
Aye.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Crummell.
Aye.
McPherson.
Aye.
Lazowski.
Aye.
Shetterly.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye. House Bill 2449 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Bob?
Yeah.
I was sort of thinking. There's a
he's a vulnerable person.
Yeah.
He
does that well. You're a vulnerable person given the definitions we were working on yesterday. So
senior privilege,
right? Yeah, senior privilege. Sure. No, I think it'll be actually a great bill for you to carry.
Senior moment in the sun.
Okay.
Thank you, Reverend.
Yeah.
Oh, good. We're glad to see we're still in a good mood.
More elder abuse.
We're gonna open a hearing on House Bill 2646 and invite Dave Hendricks to come forward. Hmm. David?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. You have before you House Bill 2646. In case you were wondering what your chair was doing last year in between special sessions, you see the product before you. House Bill 2646 is a comprehensive revision of Oregon statutes relating to judgments, comprehensive both to almost every aspect of judgments, how they're the form of the judgments, how they're entered, the effects of the judgments, and how they're enforced. It's the second half of a project that was begun last session with the passage of a comprehensive revision of the laws relating to garnishment just being one of the ways in which judgments can be enforced, but one of the most complicated series of statutes dealing with that issue. House Bill 2646 takes a step back and takes a look at all of the existing laws relating to the way judgments work and attempts to come up with some language that's a little more current than the language which currently appears in the statutes, much of which I suspect dates back to the time of the Constitution. There's some very old language in the statutes relating to judgments. It's difficult with a bill of this size to really get a handle on it. The one thing I want to say up front is that the bill should not be regarded as merely a cleanup. It does make some very substantive changes in the way attorneys will practice, and it makes some changes in the effects of documents that are submitted that are labeled as judgments. And rather than, there's no way I'm going to try to do a section by section. You should have a copy of a report that I have prepared for the Law Commission that does do a section by section that can you can go through and take a look at the individual provisions. But I think for the purposes of this meeting, it would be perhaps more helpful if I identified what at least I view as the really the truly significant and the big changes that are being made here, rather than just improvements to languages or rewriting of existing statutes to make them more clear. One of the most significant things that's been done in the bill is to create three categories of judgments, pretty firm categories, that the bill defines to be general judgments, limited judgments, and supplemental judgments. General judgments are what are frequently referred to in the existing law as quote-unquote final judgments. And the work group for a long time debated whether or not we should use that term and just call them final judgments. Final judgments being the decision of the court that was entered at the end of the case. And the significance of calling it a final judgment was usually relating to could you appeal this particular document. If you had a final judgment, the court said you could. If you did, you could not. The concern with final judgment is that final has been used in different ways, both in the statutes and in common parlance. Sometimes when you see a reference to a final judgment in the statutes, they mean it in the way I have just described it. The decision of the trial court that's entered after the case is over, that's meant to tie up all the loose ends and say, okay, that's the end of the case. If anybody's interested in appealing, now's when you're going to do it. The other way it's been used has been to talk about a truly final judgment, i.e., one in which all the appellate periods have run, or if you have, in fact, appealed and exhausted all appeals. And the work group was concerned about that concept of final, of using final for the decision at the end of the case, because the sentiment that was expressed there was that it's not really final. It's final after the appeals is over. It's just this step in the process where the trial court said, I'm done with what I'm going to do with this case. If you want to move on to the other portions of the judicial process, now's the time to do it. So the term that the work group arrived at was a general judgment for that particular item. The other types of judgments that are out there and that have created a great deal of problems for the appellate courts over time have been so-called ORCP 67B judgments. 67B judgments were judgments that didn't resolve everything in the case, that only resolved perhaps one or two of the claims. And the classic example is a judgment that was entered after a motion for a summary judgment during the trial, where perhaps one of the defendants would come in and say, I move for summary judgment. I don't think this plaintiff can win against me. There's two or three other defendants in the case the plaintiff might be able to win against, but I think I'm going to get free here. And the court agrees and grants the motion, says, you're right, you're out of here. Under ORCP 67B, that defendant could go in and submit a judgment. And if, within the language of the judgment document itself, the party used some magic words, it became final in the sense that it could be appealed at that point. And the magic words were, you had to say, the court determines that there's no just reason for delay. And while that worked fairly well, this was a way that do something what's called an interlocutory appeal that isn't an appeal from a final judgment, one that's taken before all the issues are decided. The problem with that was that if you didn't put those words in there, you frequently had documents going into the register signed by the judge that were declared to be judgments by the title, but were not judgments. Or at least you weren't able to appeal. I mean, it's very unclear about what those documents did when they went into the register. It's interesting questions about if they in fact awarded money, whether or not it became a lien, if you could enforce it, et cetera. All of these are unanswered questions. The approach taken in the bill is to change the ORCP 67B methodology and basically says there are such things as limited judgments, and they do essentially the same thing that the old ORCP 67B judgment did. It decides less than all the claims, but it is immediately appealable and it's immediately enforceable. And the way you get a limited judgment is you label it as such. There is no longer any magic language requirement. The court doesn't, you don't have to put anything into the form. You have to, it will be on the face of it. This is a limited judgment. It's appealable immediately. And if, in fact, you want it to be a judgment, if you want to appeal it or enforce it pending the entry of a general judgment, you're going to have to put that in the title. The bill puts a very strict requirement that all judgments be labeled as either a general, limited, or supplemental judgment. And this, you can look in the report and see the number of people who are in this work group. We had a very broad and very energetic work group. I think we had 16 meetings, most of them for 3 or 4 hours at a time. So there was a tremendous amount of time put into talking about these issues, and especially this one in particular, because there was a great deal of concern about malpractice opportunities for this type of requirement. The concern is that attorneys, perhaps after this bill was enacted, would put in a document not being aware of the significance of it, label it as a general judgment when, in fact, that's not what they intended. For instance, after a motion for summary judgment, the defendant who wins, who doesn't really care about whether it's a general judgment or not, submits a document called a general judgment, and the case is over. That created a lot of concern and a lot of discussion about how to address that problem. There is a section in the bill, Section 13, that was put in specifically to address that issue, and it's a special motion to allow people to essentially come back in and correct that type of error because it is such a severe error if you make it. If you accidentally label it as a general judgment and you think that's not what you wanted to get, you may have ended your case prematurely. So that's one of the big things. I would say the next most significant thing done by the bill appears in Section 11. Section 11 of the bill is an attempt to make a statement about the effect of a judgment, something we don't have in the law right now. And most of what it says is pretty anodyne, pretty harmless. But there are a couple of things in Section 11 that are very important. And the one I'll mention very specifically is that under a long line of cases by the courts have said that if you once you bring a case, and in your case, in your pleading, you've got like three causes of actions, and you've got four defendants, etc. The court has said that before you have a judgment that can be appealed, you have to have a judgment document somewhere showing what happened to every claim in the case. Now, I think for most practicing attorneys, that might be a little bit counterintuitive. And even with on the work group, we had at least a couple of attorneys who had had things happen to them under this rule where they had submitted a judgment that someone had gotten bounced out on a earlier order in the case, but there was no, didn't show up in the judgment document. You get up on appeal, and some people have gone all the way up to the Supreme Court to have the Supreme Court say, oh, there's no final judgment here. We can't find anything in the record showing what happened to this particular claim in the action, so you have to go back down to the trial court and start the appellate process over, which is a huge waste of appellate resources. And in the bill, in Section 11, there is now a statement that if you put in a judgment, and it is a general judgment, that there, it, in effect, is treated as being a judgment of dismissal with prejudice as to any claim that isn't mentioned in that document or hasn't been mentioned in one of the previous documents in the case, one of the other judgments then entered. So in effect, you don't have it in there. The assumption is that all those other claims are dismissed with prejudice. And I think, frankly, many practicing attorneys probably think that's the case now, but that's not what the cases have been holding for a long, long time. I'll mention real quickly that there will probably be a proposed amendment on that particular piece of language, a particular thought that was brought to me by Randy Jordan of the Attorney General's office, who did a wonderful job, by the way, of going over this thing almost section by section, looking for issues like this. And he noted that judgments of dismissal, for instance, these case management dismissals that courts do, where if cases aren't prosecuted, they'll dismiss them. Those cases, those provisions indicate that they're without prejudice, and we want to put some language in to make sure that we preserve that aspect of those dismissals that are voluntary dismissals or case management dismissals that the court makes. The third large thing I'd note about the bill is the elimination of decrees. And if you look at my report, the initial section kind of addresses the lingering effects of the old distinctions that we had under the common law between suits at equity and actions at law. It's rather, it strikes me as interesting that here at the beginning of this millennium, we're still dealing with things that are in the law because back in the Middle Ages in England, they had two different courts, one that was equity, one that's law. And those distinctions live on under our statutes. The ORCP, Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, when they were enacted in 1980, made a grandiose statement that all those distinctions, at least procedurally, were gone, but many of the others lived on in the statutory language. The bill would get rid of decrees. Representative Shetterly, remember sitting in a meeting about 3-4 years ago when we first talked about the problems that had risen in the divorce laws, where half of the divorce laws are now talking about decrees and half of them are talking about judgments. In fact, the principal law indicates that you get a divorce now by the entry of a judgment, but a lot of the other laws in the chapter talk about decrees. The bill gets rid of decrees as a concept. Everything is a judgment in any case that you have. Don't want to bore you to death with this. I'm just going to
touch.
Too late.
Between, I think at this point only you and I are paying any attention to this. And it's,
well, I was going to say you're still alive. I heard you say something. I'd be happy to throw it open to questions.
I think that might be. This is not. And I should state, colleagues, that this is your introduction to this subject. There are amendments which will get discussion not today, but in a future hearing. There are still some issues that we are attempting to work out with respect to some issues that were raised by the Judicial Department that we're going to try to address as well. I just want to underscore the hard work of a lot of people, least of all me, who just sort of had to sit in these meetings and preside, but really the people who did the nuts and bolts work on this bill. They're listed in the report. And if you don't actually read the report on the section-by-section comments on the proposed bill, which David was kind enough to be the author of for the Law Commission, I encourage you to read at least through the middle of page 7 of the 24 pages in the report, because I think it'll give you a flavor of what the bill is attempting to accomplish. It really is trying to fix an area of the law that has just been allowed to sort of decay, really by a long period of neglect, because nobody wanted to pick up the effort to try to address this issue in a comprehensive way. And you have a really ugly, very thick, and in many ways very technical bill in front of you, but the consequences of which for the people who live within the system are pretty significant. So it does bear, you know, our serious attention, and so I'd really recommend that you take a look at the report before you try to actually plow through the sections of the bill. And I think David gets to that point on page 7 where he talks about literally the large number of hours of both private and public attorneys who spent a considerable amount of time purely from a law improvement perspective to try to address the issue. So this is sort of your introductory opportunity to talk a little bit about this bill. Is it still a record of the longest bill of the session so far, David?
I think it's still the longest bill of the session, yes.
Okay. Yeah, good.
Beating out the revisers bill from our office by a little ways. So.
By just a little ways on the revisers bill. So I'll go ahead and open it for questions for Mr. Hendricks. If you have any specific questions about the approach or any particular language, but as I said, this won't be the first time or the only time we get to talk about this. We'll bring it back again, both for public hearing and at some point hopefully move it into work session as the amendments get finalized. The work group is actually going to be meeting sometime next week, I think, to have a conversation about some of the additional amendments. And we know that there is, as broad as you make a coalition to try to come up with a proposal and work this through the process, there are always going to be some people who weren't part of that who are going to find some things along the way, and we recognize that and, in fact, encourage that kind of an input because it is such a broad change in so many areas. Questions? Representative Brzezinski?
I was wondering if I could ask a question about Section 546.
Anybody else? Representative Ackerman?
Yes, this is a situation where when I first got this bill, I didn't think this was broken, but when I read through, I realized that the not only is it a great task, but it does clarify a lot of things. But one thing that was somewhat bothersome to me was the the creation of a judgment lien, and particularly with I think Section 5, which requires that the monetary award be placed in a certain section in a judgment document. And if you miss that technical point, your judgment lien will fail. It seems to me that might be a little bit of a triumph of form over substance. Could you help me with that?
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, that piece of the bill is actually existing law under ORCP 70. It is all couched in terms of the separate section requirement as far as getting what is now under the existing law is called a money judgment.
Right.
And the clerks in the courts, when they go to enter in the what is currently the docket, are directed by the statutory language, and I think this is in chapter 18 where it says this, to rely on the existence of the separate support, that separate money judgment section, to determine whether to docket it and thereby whether or not to create the lien. So that is actually something that's being carried forward from the existing law.
Okay, thank you.
Anything further? Okay, I mean, not because this has been a big part of my life for the last 4 years, and if that tells you how bad my life is, then you get a certain sense of it. But I really do, I can't overstate or understate, either way, I guess, but I really, it is serious business, this bill. And so I really, really encourage you to look at the report so you get an understanding of what this bill is about. So when we bring it back again for the next round of hearings, you're prepared to really talk about it or be comfortable with it one way or the other. But I just want to really commend at least the first 7 pages of that report to you. So we're prepared to move when the time comes.
Chair Williams, the only thing I'd add to that, too, is that people on the work group, we had representatives from the other bar sections. Obviously, this is kind of an attorney's bill, practicing attorney's bill.
Practicing civil attorney's bill.
Actually, there's criminal implications, and we had those folks represented in the committee and the appellate folks as well.
And Representative Przanski will want to look at it. It applies to civil and criminal judgments all the way down the line. It's comprehensive. It's everything that says judgment is affected by it. So hopefully we had enough people there to spot all the different distinctions that need to be made for all the different areas of practice that are out there. I know that some of the sections have voted to, the debtor-creditor section I know had voted to approve it, and we have not heard from the other sections, and the other people have been on the work group about having problems with it as it currently is put together.
Okay, thank you, David. Now for a more declaratory statement about the nuances of the bill, I'm going to ask John Powell to come forward. And he's going to be able to respond to your question about Section 576.
Oh, no.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And I think that the discussion that just took place will actually make my point for me. This is an attorney's bill, and it should not be interpreted by sheriffs. And that is our concern. Sections 37 and 38 that deal with sheriff's duties and the return of writ execution. In general, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, these two sections put the responsibility for tracking, computing, responding to the satisfaction of a judgment squarely on the shoulders of the sheriff. Currently, a writ is issued by a circuit court, a district attorney in family law, or a division of child support, but they are all returned to the court. The same applies when money is collected from the sale directed by a writ. It is returnable to the court at the same time. The court is then responsible for the disbursement to creditors and other debtors. Current law, ORS 23060 and ORS 23490 sub 3, put the court in line to monitor a writ of execution as it pertains to the enforcement and satisfaction of a judgment through the judicial system. A sheriff is only to carry out the order and should not be put in a position to interpret or calculate such an order or judgment. So we would recommend, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that with slight adjustments in those sections would take care of this particular problem. We also have a bill that is in this committee that we'll have a hearing later, hopefully, that deals with the sheriff's authority to enter into structures under such circumstances, that we think that that area of the law needs a slight revision as well. But in short and in summary, we just believe that the existing system for monitoring judgments and writs should be retained, and the sheriff's role should be that of execution in that light.
Okay. Are there questions for Mr. Powell? John, will you sit down with David and talk about those issues? David?
Chair Williams, I actually had an email, not from John, from Rob Beauvais.
Yes.
Coos County Council?
Yes.
Coos County Council?
No. Lincoln.
Lincoln County.
Right.
Lincoln County Council. And I have already incorporated his suggestions on two of the points into a set of amendments for the work group to look at next week. And they make perfect sense to me. It's one of the stuff on the sheriff's powers is kind of weird. I think the things that are the issues that are raised here are, again, about things that are existing law. And I think that the arguments are quite good, and I think there's a good chance the work group will say, yeah, why does it say what it does now? The other issue about breaking and entering may have to wait for the other bill, although if the committee wants to take it up, they certainly could.
Okay, thank you.
We'd probably call it something other than breaking and entering, but to forcibly enter, perhaps. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, good. Thank you. All right, we're going to close the public hearing then on House Bill 2646, and we'll be seeing that again. We're next going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2696. Council, do you want to brief us on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2696 modifies the definition of public assistance. This measure is intended to ensure that public assistance recipients get due process of law when they are denied benefits. This bill is known as the Huxford Fix. Huxford was a court of appeals case that narrowly construed the statutes governing public assistance and held that certain types of benefits do not constitute public assistance, and therefore, when those benefits were denied, revoked, or suspended, no hearing was required. This bill would essentially reverse that and reestablish that certain types of public or certain types of assistance are public assistance, such that when they are revoked, suspended, or denied, there is an opportunity for a hearing.
Okay, thank you. And we'll bring up in our first panel Lori Freeman, Martin Taylor, and Ellen Lowe. Why don't you come up since we've got a third chair and we'll move this along. You want to lead off, Lori?
I wouldn't mind doing a...
Oh, you want to lead off, Martin?
It's all right.
All right, that's all right. Yeah.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Law Center. Just sort of introducing this panel to you and saying just a few very brief remarks to give you some context for what we're dealing with today. I'm going to let Lori Freeman, who's an attorney at the Oregon Law Center, fill in most of the detail. I do think that you're going to find three things about House Bill 2696. The first is a simple maintenance of government question. Should appeal rights for folks in the TANF system getting secondary benefits go through a hearings court or through a circuit court? We would contest that the maintenance of government would try to keep that within the executive branch rather than sending the judicial branch into this process. The second is that you have a policy question where you're going to be asked really whether it's better to have consistent standards for giving benefits or whether flexibility, which sometimes is used arbitrarily, is a better process. And in this case, I think you're going to find that consistency is an asset in making determinations about where these benefits go. In part, it's an asset because it ensures that you have a less arbitrary system and you have due process. And third, I think you're going to find overwhelming support for folks that are either clients of these benefits or advocates for those clients. The Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon has submitted written testimony. We also have the Food Bank and other folks that represent these clients. So in a time when a lot of really unfortunate things are happening as a result of our budget cuts and we as a state are forced to do some things that hurt, this is an opportunity for you to give those folks who are dependent on state assistance at least one win in this session, one good thing that can come out of it for them. Finally, there's some controversy over the fiscal. I won't go into that. You're not the Ways and Means Committee. I think, needless to say, it is our assumption that a circuit court process is inherently a more costly process than a hearings officer panel within the executive branch. And if you get to the point where you need to sort some of those fiscal questions out today, we suggest bringing us back up after DHS testifies. Otherwise, maybe sending it to Ways and Means to figure that fiscal out works. That's sort of your call, Chair, but we're available after DHS if you need us. And with that, I'll turn it over to Lori.
Great. Thank you. Hi, Lori.
Thank you. Hi. Thank you for letting me be here, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The intent of House Bill 2696 is really to restore some measure of accountability in the DHS jobs program and also justice for the low-income families that are served in that program. All adult recipients of the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program, known as TANF, which is the welfare program, used to be Aid to Families with Dependent Children, they all participate in the DHS jobs program. The intent of the jobs program is to get people back to work. Now, once they're participating in the jobs program, they're entitled to job support service payments, which are supplemental payments on top of their monthly TANF grant, which help them remove the barriers to employment. Typically, it's assistance with child care, transportation expenses. You know, I need to get my car fixed so I can look for work or go back to work. I need tools to start on this job. It's a whole wide range of payments that could be made available to reduce the barriers to employment. In February of 2000, DHS amended its administrative rule to provide that you may not have a contested case hearing if a job support service payment is denied, unless that payment is for shelter or for basic living expenses. This policy change was challenged, and as your committee counsel explained, that resulted in the decision Huxford versus Adult and Family Services, in which the Court of Appeals narrowly construed the public assistance statutes and held that these support service payments are not public assistance. There is no criteria governing when they are to be provided. They're discretionary. Therefore, there's no right to due process. As a result of that decision, now low-income TANF families who are denied jobs payments are required to go into circuit court and challenge these as orders and other than contested cases. Now, DHS has its own reasons for opposing this bill, and I guess we'll hear those in a few minutes. I'm not privy to them. But, of course, this committee has the responsibility and the opportunity to look at the impact on the state as a whole and not just the interests of DHS. And from that vantage point, this bill is really good public policy. The first reason for that is because the denial of contested case hearings pushes these cases into circuit court. And as you are all very well aware, the circuit courts don't need any additional burdens at this time. Second, the denial of contested case hearings on these payments creates additional burdens on the Attorney General's office. And just this morning, there was a bill heard in the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senate Bill 100. The aim of that is to get these orders and other than contested cases back out of the circuit court and into the agency. So it's also more costly for the Attorney General to prosecute these cases. DHS pays them about $90 per hour. Recently, there was a case that settled in Multnomah County for $50. The family needed $50 for their cell phone because the husband publicized that cell phone number in his contracting business. The payment was denied. They had to go to circuit court. Settled for $50, DHS probably paid the Attorney General's office about $900 to defend them in that case. Then there's the burden on the nonprofit legal services community. I'm sure you're all also aware of how thinly staffed these days legal services offices are, suffering from the same budget problems that the state is facing. And so in many of the rural offices, they have toll-free hotlines. They have educational brochures that they develop where they can advise clients on how to represent themselves in contested case hearings. And that self-advocacy has been very successful for legal services programs. But when it comes to representing a client in a circuit court proceeding, they just simply do not have the resources to do that. Even in Multnomah County, which is the largest legal services program in the state, they were able to file only a handful of these cases. So this policy essentially then denies access to the courts or to any remedy for residents in many rural areas of the state. Thus, the burden on state resources seem to far outweigh the burden on DHS, but even for DHS, it's good public policy. Under the current system, there's no assurances of accountability. When an individual caseworker denies a support service payment, without the ability to appeal that through a contested case hearing, there is no form of oversight. Supervisors aren't checking on these decisions. As a result, there can be gross overspending by some workers and, of course, the cases we see, underspending by other workers. There's just no uniformity. There's no accountability within the agency for these payments. And part of the bill requires the agency to set some standards. Now, admittedly, due process can slow things down. Government agencies certainly can move more swiftly by denying citizens due process of law. But due process is a fundamental principle of our democracy, and in the long run, it leads to better, more accountable government agencies and benefits all citizens. Now, it's my understanding that DHS opposes this bill on two bases. One is the burden on staff, and I think I've already addressed that. And the other is the fiscal impact. And the rest of my comments are really targeted to those two issues, but since I'm not really sure what the bases are for DHS's opposition to the bill, I'll hold those comments, and if you'd like to, I mean, the information is there if you'd like to read it. Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. Let's go ahead and hear from Ellen, and then we'll do questions.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I serve as a legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank. We are a statewide hunger relief network dedicated not only to eliminating hunger, but the root causes of hunger. And we work through 20 regional agencies that in turn work through more than 800 food pantries, soup kitchens, shelters, child care centers in order to distribute food and assist with the nutrition of Oregonians. Now, we often in these places see Oregonians at their time of financial crisis and dependency, and we also see them as they struggle to move out of this dependency. And part of this may be because of the Oregon threshold for receiving public assistance. For example, for a family of three, temporary assistance for needy families, your income has to be under $616. You can't have cash resources of more than $2,500, and your monthly stipend is $498 a month. That's $5 less than it was in 1991. There has not been an increase, just a decrease in the amount. And so we really, in Oregon, before we even provide any kind of public assistance, they are in real crisis. Now, we believe that the Huxford fix, as it's been labeled, House Bill 2696, really provides a timely second chance for folks who have met a denial when they have sought job supports, sometimes life supports. For such assistance, it may be work shoes for a job, a battery or a tire for that aging automobile, moving assistance to stable housing, gaining a telephone, as Lori indicated. Now, we also know that sometimes people in crisis are not at their most tactful in personal communication. And so we understand that there may be times when there is a conflict between someone coming for assistance and the case manager who meets them and talks with them. And so that's why we think it is so crucial that there be a timely second chance, this contested case hearing that would allow a review of what they're requesting, so that they don't have to wait to go to circuit court. Because really what we're talking about is moving people out of dependency, And it isn't just the check sometimes. It's these extra services that give them then the capacity to be on their way out of that kind of dependency. The Oregon Food Bank conducted a series of focus groups across the state recently. And it was interesting when we talked with low-income Oregonians what they had to say to us. And that's number one on their list. We're more programs, more services to help them get back to work. And we see the Huxford Fix as giving them a second chance in terms of gaining materials that are crucial to them. This the current system may be faster. It may be more expedient for the bureaucracy. What it's going to do is to slow down, continue to slow down, and place barriers on low-income Oregonians who do want to become part of the productive workplace. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. And we'll go ahead and have some questions. I wanted to sort of clarify again my own understanding of what the bill is trying to address. Currently, if there's a denial of these particular areas of public assistance where the law doesn't already allow for an administrative hearing, you're left only with the option at that point of under Chapter 183, which is the administrative section of our ORSs, of treating this as an order in other than a contested case, and then you have to file your challenge to the denial of assistance in circuit court.
That's correct, Mr. Yes. Chair.
And what this bill would do would be allow you to use the administrative law procedure and essentially continue your opportunity to file that challenge as a contested case proceeding with the agency as opposed to filing as an order in other than a contested case in circuit court.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So just if that helps anybody else, I needed to restate it for myself just to make sure I understood what the bill was actually accomplishing. Sure. Representative Shetterly.
Yeah, so I think taking that one step further, the question I guess the bill addresses is whether the venue for review is going to be circuit court or the hearing officer panel. Those are the two choices. That's where those trails lead, either circuit court or administrative review would be to the hearing officer panel.
Right. Okay. Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kremel and then Representative Ackerman.
Thank you. I see in Section 15 that it's going to repeal ORS 411, 121, 860, and 865. 121, I don't think is quite is an issue, but 860 and 865 is the code having to do with work relief and general assistance applicants and recipients. And I'm just curious as to whether or not this is actually a good idea to eliminate those programs, because as I read these, and I have no reason to really study these, and I'm not an attorney, but as I read these, they appear to be parts of the statute that require employable applicants for general assistance to participate in community work and training programs. And so am I missing something here as to, I guess I'm questioning the value in eliminating that. Can you help me understand that a little bit?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, part of this was a cleanup as the Legislative Council was going through and drafting this. The intent was to go through and identify all the places where the statute refers to a grant of public assistance, because that's what the court relied upon in Huxford. And when they got to those statutes, they found that they're just currently, the DHS isn't running a general assistance program. They eliminated it in January. But aside from that, the standard for general assistance is that you must be disabled and unable to work. So a lot of those community work and training statutes were passed back in 1939 and early on when the state did provide work relief programs. But over the years, it was narrowed down to just people who qualify for SSI, federal disability benefits, and it's an interim program for people who are waiting for their disability benefits to kick in. So it just became unnecessary to have any provisions about community work and training programs for general assistance.
Okay. Follow up, Mr.
You may follow up.
Going back to the first section of the bill, J and K, I guess it would be section 1, sub 2, or excuse me, sub 3, J and K. Is this the part of the bill that sort of opens the door and, I mean, throws the door open to everything that might ever be thought of so that someone that is getting any kind of assistance, if they are denied a benefit, can go for a contested case hearing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, the J was really intended to focus on the job support service payments. It's difficult if you put job support service payments in there, then the agency can start calling them something else. And so this language focuses on what the Court of Appeals referred to in their decision. They called the support service payments as payments or services used to support participation in a public assistance program. So we were just trying to track the language of the Court of Appeals opinion.
Okay. Well, I view that as being very very broad type of language, and I'm just, well, I mean, if that's the goal of the bill, then it's, I understand, but I'm trying to just sort of figure out if we're sort of just trying to make sure that we throw the door open.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, on the there's food stamp benefits and other benefits listed in here. Of course, this public assistance statute, as you can see, is very broad in itself. Subsection 1 defines general assistance, which is also comes under subsection 3. I'm sorry, subsection 2. And subsection 2 defines general assistance as assistance or service of any character provided to needy persons. So it's already a very broad definition.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I just wanted to note to see if this is correct. If you appeal these cases now to circuit court, one does incur a filing fee and perhaps a trial fee when the matter is heard. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that is correct. In all of our cases so far, we've been able to get a deferral of the filing fee, but, of course, that's still a debt that's owed.
And that deferral is something different from a waiver. In other words, there's some point in time that before a judgment would be entered, you'd have to make good on the deferral cost. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And in your recollections, how much is a filing fee or trial fees under the current system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I believe it's around $125 right now for a filing fee.
Okay. And there's no such filing fees or costs in the administrative law proceeding, is there?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Is it accurate also, if I could, Lori, that in these cases when, and you may have testified to this in your testimony, and I may have been distracted at that moment, but when you prevailed in these cases against DHS in the circuit court proceeding, that you're entitled to recovery of your attorney's fees in those cases?
That's correct. In one particular case, Grass versus DHS, we ultimately settled the case for $10,000 in attorney's fees to my office, $13,000 in damages to the client, on top of probably several thousand dollars paid to the Attorney General's office plus costs. So it was a total of $22,000 for one case alone.
There are further questions? I received an email from Ms. Freeman, which was a copy of an email sort of discussing the fiscal. There's been and we just might as well lay this one on the table for the committee. There's been an ongoing dispute between DHS and the proponents of the bill as to what the fiscal would be. I think it is going to be my intent to at least spend some time on that issue in this committee before we make the policy decision about sending it down, in part because I think it's appropriate that we, you know, at least lay the foundation for that discussion here. But I'm not going to make you do that now. I think we'll go ahead and have VHS people come up. They can talk. They may want to get into their version of the fiscal. My hope was, before we sort of, you know, put the fiscal on trial here in front of the committee, that there could be a bit more back and forth between the parties and to try to narrow that. I will just say that I was relatively persuaded in my initial reading of the material that the DHS fiscal was larger and made assumptions that seemed to me not to be accurate. That being said, I think it would behoove all of you to work together a little bit more before we put the fiscal on trial here in the committee. So that's going to be my suggestion to you as well as my suggestion to DHS. But they get to say whatever they want when they come up here, so that's we'll see where it takes us. Okay. With no questions, then we'll bring up the next panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Michael Buckley and Elizabeth Lopez.
I would point out, Mr. Chair, that as long as it's truthful, they can say whatever they want to when they come up. As are, I believe, there's a deal at the top of the sign-in sheets now, isn't there?
Yeah. Truth is such a hard thing to define. Welcome, everyone. And there's a third person there that I don't know, so who is that?
Chair Williams, my name is Mark Troseth, T-R-O-S-E-T-H, and I also am from the Department of Human Services.
And it's Mark?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. And are you testifying in favor or against with your other two?
If I have to testify, it would be against the bill.
Okay, well, the other two have marked against, so I just wanted to make sure we were all on the same side here. So, okay, who wants to lead off?
Chair Williams, I'll start off. My name is Chair Williams, members of the committee. My name is Michael Buckley, and I'm the Acting Administrator for Self-Sufficiency and Child Safety within the Department of Human Services. And I'm here to testify in opposition to 2696. I think the previous panel has pretty much reviewed in terms of defining what this bill does in terms of the definition of payments and services and redefining them under public assistance, so I don't think I need to go through those issues. I think it does further require that items defined as public assistance be subject to those requirements that were previously governed only under public assistance grants or maintenance grants of living expenses as we define them. I believe that was covered as well. And this bill does require the department, as previously stated, to establish standards for support service payments and services provided. Our concerns about this bill are the amount of administrative complexity it would establish within the program itself. Right now, the way this program operates, it is a very flexible program. And in fact, flexibility is its hallmark. Its basic premise of the program is flexibility in terms of working with individuals. Each individual is different. Their needs are different. And case managers, through an assessment process, really determine what an individual needs, both in terms of services and support service payments to help them to participate. And then from that process, essentially craft a case plan that kind of outlines the process by which we're going to work with an individual or family through this program. It's very fluid. It's very flexible. One of the complications of establishing standards is that those case managers would then be pretty much confined within. The department would have to essentially go through and define the parameters or the conditions under which both support service payments and services are provided, thereby eliminating or reducing a lot of the flexibility that the program operates with now. We serve 20,000 participants each month. Each of those individuals has a service plan, a case plan, that kind of defines the services and the support services that we provide. There are 12,000 service plan transactions every month. So, in other words, that service plan is not a static plan. Activities are developed and put into the plan, negotiated. There are 12,000 of those every month. There are 9,000 support service payments made each month. Individual support service payments of 9,000, totaling $1.5 million every month. You add those together, that's 21,000 transactions each month that are not subject at the present time to an administrative hearing process that would now fall under the administrative hearing process. That's a sizable addition of transactions that would come under this process. And it lies the problem in terms of what this presents to the department, the increased complexity of the extent to which it will make the program more complex. How those issues are dealt with now in terms of disputes, there is a conciliation process that is used now. It's informal. The first level of in that conciliation process is if a participant disagrees with either a support service payment or an activity, they contact their worker and they talk about it. And if they're unable to resolve it, then immediately there is a branch level review from the administrator, branch manager, or supervisor in that office to review the action and attempt to resolve the dispute. So there is a conciliation process on disputed payments, but it does not reach obviously formal administrative review process. Standards and support service payments. Right now, as I mentioned, the payments are very flexible to meet client need. Standards would severely limit that kind of flexibility. Let me give you an example of what I mean. When we first set up this program and we tried and we were establishing support service policy and purposes under which we would be providing support services, one of the things that clearly was not thought of in terms of finding definition and anything was the extent to which case managers would make support service payments for utilities. Now, families already receive a grant to cover maintenance, housing, rent, utilities, basic household expenses. But the thought that we would cover utilities as a job support service need clearly wasn't something that was thought of. Yet, because of the way the program operates, case managers really have a charge or responsibility to try to provide whatever the client needs to be successful within certain parameters, of course, within some reasonable limits. And one of those that really came about was utility payments. So right now, our case managers routinely provide $50,000, $60,000 worth of utility payments every month. That isn't something that probably would have ever happened had we started out in this program with some rigidly defined parameters for support service payments, simply because we'd be concentrating on child care, transportation, tools, equipment, clothing for necessary to engage in activities. It's when you have a flexible system, it allows the case manager to kind of craft things to where the client need is. Standards seem counterproductive in that way. The same could be held true for services provided in the program as well. Right now, what kinds of services an individual is enrolled in is really through a process of assessment and agreement with the client. We provide those services through a fairly complex structure of contracted services. In other words, we go out and contract with providers, community colleges, and other organizations such as the Title I under the Workforce Investment Act provider for a contracted list of services. So our funding, our ability to pay for services is already tied up in a contractual relationship with an organization. To have that process then go under more of a dispute process will increase the complexity under which the program operates. I'm not sure how we would, if a person didn't want to go through a particular activity that we funded through the community college program, they wanted to go do this activity over here, the program very well may not have enough money to go pay for that service because we've tied the funding up in terms of contracted or services that the program has designed into it to meet need. So the result is a significantly increased program complexity that we're not really sure will ultimately work in the participant's favor. And it would propose to make adjustments in a program that frankly works fairly well as it is. This program works very well. In regards to the fiscal impact, we frankly are uncertain about what the number of hearings that would really result as a result of this passage of this bill. We do know that there are 21,000 transactions each month that would now be subject to a hearing process, potentially. That's 252,000 transactions per year that at least have the realm of possibility of becoming hearable issues. Right now, we have 8.4 jobs-related hearings a month for a cost, for a yearly cost of $139,000. Average eight and a half jobs-related hearings. Most of those hearings are really regarding cooperation. And that costs us about $139,000 a year. In trying to figure out what the potential cost of this program, what this change would be, we clearly know that is at least, we're trying to establish some parameters. That is clearly one of the parameters in terms of not changing anything. This is as it is now, so we can clearly, comfortably say, well, at least that's one side of the parameter. The other parameter, what we tried to estimate is well, what would happen if each worker, of which there are 377 workers statewide, had one contested hearing request through this process each month. So that's less than 2% of that 21,000 transactions. The cost of that, that 377, and then we figured out of 337 requests, let's say half of them would be normally resolved in a conciliation process, so they wouldn't actually go to a hearing. That would still leave us with 188 hearings per month. And the cost of that we've estimated to be $4.4 million a year. Essentially, $2.5 million of that is continued assistance, because in our administrative hearing process, a client has the right to continued assistance. But also, essentially, it takes 2 months for us to get through to a hearing process now. And so 2 months of assistance is kind of figured in on our estimate of this 188 cases. 2 months of additional assistance, assuming that if we weren't backed up on those 2 months, then we'd be able to gauge the participant in services and be two months further down the road in terms of them achieving self-sufficiency. So there is our range between what it is now, $140,000 a year, to potentially as high as 4.4. Where in that range this lands, we really don't know. We don't have a way of knowing that. We just simply don't have a way to really realistically project. We know that the only cases that go through administrative review now through a formal hearings process are cases that are sanctioned. We have less than 5% of our caseload sanctioned at any point in time. Again, we have 20,000 cases. And we know that this brings 21,000 transactions within the realm of possibility every month. So those we know to be true. But how that translates into number of cases that would actually come to a formal administrative hearing, we don't have a way to determine that at this point. So, in conclusion, I think I just want to say that the jobs program serves a large population every month. It does still suit through a complex structure of contracts and case management systems of support service payments. This system is not as stingy in terms of support service payments. We spend over half of our funding on support service payments. That's $1.5 million a month. This is not a stingy program. The bill would create additional complexity at the expense of the efficiency of the program, and for those reasons, the department opposes this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Williams, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Lopez, and I am the administrator of the Office of Employment and Financial Benefits. We are part of the Department of Human Services serving seniors and people with disabilities. And we believe that the broadening of the public assistance definition has some very significant unintended fiscal consequences for the programs that we offer. Seniors and people with disabilities administers a variety of public assistance programs, and we contract with local area agencies on aging to administer those programs in their local areas. A vast majority of our programs do have hearings rights, but we believe that this bill expands the hearings rights to other programs and other processes that are working quite well. In addition to some potential food stamp impacts that Michael talked about, the bill would have significant impacts on other programs such as Oregon Project Independence and our Older American Act programs. We currently have review processes and grievance processes established in all of our area agencies on aging. They're built right into our contracts. And if a client wishes, they can resolve disputes beyond that with seniors and people with disabilities. As an example, if a client wants to receive home-delivered meals, but they're able to participate in a congregate meal program, those home-delivered meals would not be provided. There currently is not an administrative review process. If an individual has a dispute with that decision, that dispute is resolved locally, and then if it can't be resolved locally, it can then come to seniors and people with disabilities for central office input. We believe that this bill would preempt that local review process and move these decisions into a contested case hearing process. Currently, Oregon Project Independence clients can request an administrative hearing once they've exhausted that local and state review process that is built into our contracts. We believe that this bill bypasses that process. And again, the department would incur the cost of the hearing. And not only that, but it would minimize the role of the local agencies charged with administering these programs. Individuals participating in our Senior Community Services Employment Program have a right to a hearing that's built into the Older Americans Act. These hearings rights are with the U.S. Department of Labor. We believe that the bill would require us to establish a duplicative administrative review process. Lastly, Section 13H of the bill adds payments or benefits paid to a third party to the definition of public assistance. We believe that this could open up hearings rights to our client employed providers as the state pays those providers. These individuals currently have hearings rights if they dispute their ability to be listed as a provider, due to criminal records check. However, we believe the bill would open this up to disputes ranging from hourly wage, number of hours authorized, etc. SPD believes that House Bill 2696 would dramatically increase the number of hearings and would drive up the cost of administering public assistance programs. This, of course, would have significant impacts on the state and on the programs that we're able to offer. We currently have about 130,000 individuals who participate in our Older American Act services. We have approximately 20,000 individuals who receive services through client-employed providers, and approximately 7,000 individuals who participate in Oregon Project Independence. We support the client's right to a hearing, but we're concerned with what we believe are unintended consequences. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lopez. Mr. Fossa?
Chair Williams, would it make sense for me to defer and allow time for questions of the first two witnesses, given the time?
Are you going to say the same thing that the other two did? Unintended consequences, increase the costs?
I have some different points. I can make them very quickly.
Yeah, if you make them quickly, we'd like to get them on the record.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, I will just make a few points. First is, in general, the money that goes into these job support service payments, with some exceptions, which Mr. Buckley mentioned, are used to help the client look for work or become able to work. And these are different from the grant, which is used for the client's basic needs of living. The client's basic needs of living grant is protected by the contested case hearings process. And so I think it's important to keep that distinction in mind. If this bill passes, DHS will have to give formal notice with right to a hearing in all of the many transactions described by Mr. Buckley. I believe it was 20-some thousand a month. That would be completely new. It would make this process much more formal than it is now, slowing it down and subjecting the client to additional process. This bill is called the Huxford Fix. I think we should look at the Huxford case just ever so briefly. It arose over a dispute where the client came in and asked the department to pay her car rent so that she could look for work in Portland. The branch office said she could use the public transportation system. That case dragged on for 4.5 years before the Supreme Court denied writs. During the oral argument in the Court of Appeals, one of the judges questioned very sagely, I think. He said, do you mean we could have this dispute and have it go to a contested case hearing over the question of whether a client gets one bus token or two bus tokens? And the answer was yes. That's the kind of issues that would be hearable if this bill passes. That's why it's difficult to assess the total effects of this bill. And with that, Chair Williams, I conclude.
Okay, well, good. We'll open it up to some questions. And this is more, I guess, a comment from me than it is a question. I recognize the need for flexibility in a program like this. At the same time, one person's flexibility is another person's arbitrariness. And I think that given some of the information that I've heard, that there are offices and particular caseworkers who you don't want to be with or you don't want to go to because of the arbitrary nature in which they make the determination about your accessibility to certain kinds of benefits. And so it's tough from our perspective because we want a flexible program that works given the facts of a particular case. Flip side is we want a program with standards so that regardless of where you're at in the state, certain kinds of things are going to be addressed in the same way and aren't going to be arbitrary given one office to the next. And I think that's the issue with me with respect to standards. The flip side is that to the extent these people can go in and challenge these as cases in other than a contested case proceeding, it just I'm still struggling on the nature of how much real cost there are going to be by opening this thing up to that process. But we can, I'm sort of wanting to hold as much of the discussion about the fiscal impact issue until a later time and focus most on the policy.
Well, thanks. And I do want to respond to that because I think you asked a good question there. And I think part of the reason is that currently my expectation is that these clients are not being provided any notice of their right to seek review in circuit court in an other than contested case proceeding. And so they simply don't know that they have the right to review, which is why one of the reasons you're not going to see that level of review being sought, whereas this bill would bring them under the administrative hearings process, which does include at least a notice that says if you're dissatisfied with the decision of the agency, you've got the right to request a hearing. frankly, I think a lot of this is not being reviewed right now because these folks don't know that they've got a right to have this reviewed.
Yeah, that's a difficult policy to feel comfortable with in some respects. Anyway, Representative Crummell, you have a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess it's wandering into the issue that you were, I think, not wanting to get into, which is trying the fiscal impact here today. I'll leave it as a question for you to answer at a later time, and that is, why do you think that you'll have the increases in hearings that you're stating that you're afraid that you're going to have if we start? I mean, is it sort of if we keep them in the dark, then they don't know that they can have a review, so consequently we don't have to worry about it? I mean, because I think that's a pretty poor way for the government to do business.
You can't set that one up and not let him give him a chance to respond to that, Jerry. I gotta give him at least an opportunity to say something.
Chair Williams, thank you very much, Chair Williams, Representative Crummell. We routinely provide the opportunity to request for conciliation process. As for the reasonableness of our estimate, and or at least in terms of the reasonableness of our concern, just in terms of straight percentages, you're bringing into the level of play a lot more transactions, and it's less than two. Even on our outside, in terms of the most severest impact, we're saying less than 2% would potentially go to an administrative hearing. Right now, we have administrative hearings on sanctions that, again, are less than 5% of the caseload. I think we were being fairly conservative in terms of establishing our range. I don't think that we were being outlandish at trying to set those parameters. We're clearly not trying to scare people off in terms of what this would really do. I think we're trying to have a reasonable approach to, I mean, what would really be the impact of this? And again, we don't have a way to really nail it down concretely. But in terms of reasonableness, I think it's reasonable to assume any number of actions that an agency takes, a small percentage of them are going to go through an administrative hearing process.
Chair Williams, Representative Crummell, I just want to add that for services to seniors and people with disabilities, there absolutely is a grievance and review process built in. Our belief is that this bill would preempt that process and move those decisions into the contested case hearing.
Thank you.
I want to give everybody a chance. We've got a couple of other bills I want to try to get to that I think will be quick in work session. And what I'm going to ask is the sides here who've heard each other's testimony to address the issues of the unintentional consequence impacts to see if there's something that can be done there, and then to at least get to a point where we can bring them forward to have the discussion about the competing fiscal at another time. That would be the chair's intent. So if that does anything to help narrow the field of questioning.
In fact, I was not going to ask a question that needs a response. I was going to invite information on the average cost of the benefits per month that are being sought in the class of claim that it might go to hearing, in relation to the cost of holding the hearings. I think that relationship is a pretty significant aspect of the fiscal analysis, and I would, without asking for a response today, I would like to see that.
That's fair, and I appreciate that, Representative.
Yes, very quickly on how the parties might get together on this. On page, two of Mr. Buckley's statement, there's a statement that the bill requires DHS to resolve disagreements over job activities or support service payments through a formal contested case hearings process. I don't think the bill does that, but rather than argue about it today, I would think that you might want to come back with some idea of how to successfully conciliate or mediate these disputes before you reach the hearings process.
Anybody else?
We could incorporate that in the bill.
Anybody else? Representative Jensen?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I'm not terribly sympathetic with the department, I guess, on this, and I am concerned about the concern that this would dramatically increase the number of hearings. And I realize the department responded, you know, or the agencies responded to Representative Crummell's concern. I still share some of that concern with Representative Crummell and will intend to pursue that when we come back if it isn't somehow or another addressed.
Good, fair enough.
One more thing.
Yeah, sure.
If I may, I don't, being familiar with the hearing officer panel, I don't agree that the process that moves cases to the panel divests the agency of the ability to conciliate. I mean, that still right. is an ongoing part, even of the contested case proceeding. So I think we made very clear that that was going to be the case when we established the panel, that this was not going to intended to supplant, that's right, any kind of alternative dispute resolution or conciliation that it still agencies would still be able to pursue and, in fact, encouraged to pursue. So I don't want that to be out there as closing off opportunity for conciliation and mediation within the agency, even while we allow for a hearing process.
Okay. Good. Well, that was a healthy discussion. I appreciate it, committee. Thank you very much, panel. Mm-hmm. We're now going to close House Bill 2696. We're going to try to move quickly through, and I know we're over time again, colleagues, but...
at least it's not 6:30.
Yeah, at least it's not the evening, right? We're going to move quickly into the work session. We're going to go ahead and start, because Mr. Prinz isn't here, but will be momentarily. So we're going to start with House Bill 2275, and we'll open a work session on that. It's an oldie but a goodie. You'll recall it. We've had it a couple of times. We've got amendments. Hopefully they're the right ones.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have both on 2275 and 2276 two sets of amendments, the dash fours and the dash fives. And I understand that at least Wendy provided me with some handouts, which you might want to bring up now. If you remember correctly, the last time we heard both of these bills, and I'll just summarize them together, one of the issues was when a tort claim notice is now overdue in a situation where there was no prior cause of action for discrimination in the case of 2275 based on age in a place of public accommodation. The 180 days has now long run for tort claim actions, and these amendments were asked for to deal with that issue. There are two different amendments, the dash fourth and dash fives, in order to give the committee a chance to make a policy decision with regard to the time limitations that they're going to allow for those tort claim notices to be filed.
And we've got Marcia back with us from Boley. Welcome, Marcia.
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee.
All right, so help us again. Which one one of them opens it up generally, one of them opens it up with the tort claims piece to it. Is that right?
Actually, Chair Williams, both amendments cover several different features, so I'll just run you through those quickly.
Okay.
And then they differ only in one respect, and so that's the only choice to really be concerned about, I believe. Both the dash 4 and dash 5 amendments would say that all conduct occurring between the two points in time, first when age discrimination erroneously went out of the public accommodations statute, and when it would come back in, which would be the effective date of the underlying bill, 2275, all those actions would be subject to claims of discrimination. So both the amendments would do that. Both amendments would provide that a tort claim notice could be given within 180 days after the effective date of House Bill 2275, so they would take care of the problem that Representative Ackerman was concerned about at the last work session. Both the Dash 4 and Dash 5 amendments would provide for non-revival of any civil actions in which judgment has already been entered before the effective date of the underlying bill. So you're not going to reopen old cases that have already been resolved. And finally, both amendments provide an emergency clause making the bill effective upon passage because of the nature of the bill, which is to correct an error in the current law. Now, as far as the differences, the only difference, the Dash 5 amendments, in effect, save all complaints that would otherwise be lost by the drafting error by providing that complaints to the Bureau may be filed within 1 year of discrimination. That notwithstanding the statute that requires complaints to be filed with the Bureau within 1 year of discrimination, a complaint of age discrimination in public accommodations based on conduct that occurred after January 1, 2002 and before the effective date of 2275 may be filed within 1 year of the effective date of 2275. So what you're saying is any cause of action, age discrimination that arose in that period of time may be brought within 1 year of the date the bill becomes effective. The Dash 4 amendments are more limited as far as what complaints could come in. It would allow complaints to be filed with the Bureau only for conduct that occurred within 1 year prior to the effective date of the bill. And that would make it consistent with 659A820, which requires that complaints to the Bureau be filed within 1 year of the unlawful practice. So one is a more limited time frame of complaints. One is broader. The Bureau's preference would be 2275-5, simply because it saves all complaints. And this whole bill is the result of an error that the legislature never intended in the first place, and never intended age to be withdrawn as a protected class in public accommodation.
We blame the chair of the Oregon Law Commission.
What about the Judiciary Committee last session?
Mr. Chair, I'm just sorry Dave Hendricks left, because I was going to blame him again.
That's right. You can blame. All right. He's listening, though, I know, so we'll blame Dave in absentia. Okay, thank you, Marcia. So we're in work session. We've got the Dash 4s and the Dash 5s, and you've heard a preference by the department for the Dash 5s, and you understand the distinctions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I move the Dash 5s into House Bill 2275.
Okay, let's have discussion.
A question for Marcia.
Marcia.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. Marcia, as I recall from conversation, I don't remember whether it was on the record or off after the hearing last. As far as we know, there have not been any claims that have been rejected on account of this drafting error.
We are not aware of any, Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly.
Okay.
Okay, so it's the motion is on the Dash 5s. Is there any further discussion?
I don't know. It seems like there have not been any claims rejected. Then I guess there haven't been any claims asserted. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know that we need to necessarily give them an extra year.
The only difference I could see, Representative, is if somebody had withheld making.
Sure, that's a possibility.
Because they had read had read the statute with the change in it and determined not to assert a claim because they didn't find it in the statute, and this would fix that piece of it, Representative Ackerman.
Or I think if they had the right to file in district court, which I think there is concurrent jurisdiction, and then got dismissed.
Okay.
Anybody else want to add to the discussion? Okay, the motion is on the Dash 5s. Is there objection to the Dash 5s? Hearing none, the Dash 5s are in.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I move House Bill 2275 as amended for due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves House Bill 2275 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Hearing none, Nancy, call the roll.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. House Bill 2275 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll make Representative Shetterly carry.
No, thanks.
We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2276. This one will look a lot alike. Marcia, you want to come up? Again, we've got a Dash 4 and a Dash 5 amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this requires just a slight change in thinking, because this underlying bill addresses another drafting error that was made in the redrafting of Chapter 659A, and that was that the private rights of action for injured workers who are not reinstated or reemployed to their jobs were changed so that formerly where they included compensatory and punitive damages, they were changed to reinstatement and back pay only. Again, unintentional on the part of the legislature, strictly a drafting error. So what the bill would do is restore the private rights of action as they were prior to the drafting error. Both amendments before you, 2276-4 and 2276-5, would provide that these rights of action would cover, the restored rights of action would cover all conduct occurring between January 1st, 2002, which was the date when the erroneous drafting error became effective, and the effective date of House Bill 2276. Both amendments would provide that a tort claim notice could be given within 180 days after the effective date of the act in cases of claims against public bodies. Both amendments would provide for non-revival of civil actions in which judgments have already been entered before the effective date of the underlying bill, and both amendments would provide for an emergency clause. The differences, again, between the Dash 4 and Dash 5 amendments, the Dash 4 amendments to 2276 allow claims to be filed only for conduct that occurred within 1 year prior to the effective date of House Bill 2276, consistent with ORS 659A875, requiring that claims be filed within 1 year of the alleged unlawful practice. And the Dash 5 amendments to 2276, in contrast, provide that notwithstanding 659A875, claims of failure to reinstate or reemploy injured workers where the conduct occurred between the two dates of importance may be filed within 1 year after the date of enactment of 2276, period. So you'd cover that whole window of potentially claims that didn't get filed because the private rights were changed in error.
Okay, thank you. Why don't you stay put in case there are questions, and we'll just open it up right now for committee discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shadow.
I think the decision we made in 2275 pretty well dictates the same policy decision, doesn't it, in 2276, so I'd move the Dash 5.
It does seem appropriate. It would be inconsistent, it seems, to go one way on one and one on the other. All right, so we will, and Marcia, is the Dash 5 the recommendation from Foley as well?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So Representative Shetterly has moved the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2276. Is there discussion on this motion? Is there objection? The amendments are adopted. Representative Shetterly?
Moved House Bill 2276 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2276 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Okay.
Canty?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Marker?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. House Bill 2276 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll assign it to anybody who wants to carry it. In some ways, it would be good to have you carry it because it's going to sound like deja vu all over again. It'll be the same speech. I don't think anybody will know what you're talking about. So, anyway, it'd be funny to watch.
We should put them both on the board at the same time.
Yeah, so Representative Shetterly will carry that bill as well. And now we're going to go to a work session on House Bill 2177. And Council Prinz is with us.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you. This is going back to January 20th. We had a hearing on the stocking order bill related to Department of Corrections. And you should have in a packet the Dash 6 amendments, which are before you. One moment, please. I had a memo myself and the chairman's assistant. We sent a memo regarding the Dash 5 amendments. The Dash 6 amendments are the Dash 5 amendments with an emergency clause. The Dash 6 amendments deal with stocking protective orders again. They would make sure it's clear that the bar against stocking protective orders would apply to a court one, which would be under ORS 30.866, or the other mode of getting a stocking order, which would be through a police officer citation. So under these amendments,
You would not be able to get a stocking order in either of those manners under two scenarios. One, a buyer on behalf of a person who's in the legal or physical custody of a law enforcement unit, and I included the statutory definition of a law enforcement unit in the packet of information for you. It is a broad definition that I think would take care of most situations, or is in the custody under ORS Chapter 419C. This is the delinquency statute. So this would, a person who's in custody of any law enforcement unit or in juvenile detention would not be able to get a stocking order. Certainly there are other means of redress for corrections, for example, or something else in that scenario. And again, I think the policy question is a stocking order the right way to do that if someone's in custody? The second portion of this would be subsection C under the Dash 6's amendments. And this would say you cannot get a stocking or protective order by or on behalf of a person not described in paragraph B, which would mean not in custody, to or against another person who is a parole or probation officer or an officer, employee, or agent of a law enforcement unit. Again, this broad definition, I think, will hit upon all those people who, as part of their official duties, investigate crimes, basically. And this portion would have acting within the scope of the person's official duties. So if there is a outside the official duties, say if I'm a police officer but I'm stalking you off hours, mm-hmm. then you could get a stalking protective order. And then Section 2 is just an emergency clause.
Mr. Chair. Thanks. Yeah, and just Representative Brzezinski, we did send out, again, the Dash 6s are like the Dash 5s with just the addition of the emergency clause. And we got feedback from most of the members that they like the Dash 5s better than the Dash 4s. So that just gives you a sense, because I know it's been a while since we sent that memo around. Representative Brzezinski, and yeah. If anybody needs to know what they said on their memo back to me, just ask, and I'll tell you what you liked when you filled out the memo. Representative Brzezinski.
I believe I was on the Dash 5 crowd, but just to make sure with counsel, the reason that we have acting within their scope of their authorities, because the individual who could be seeking the stalking order is out of custody as compared to the individuals. If you're in custody, you're not going to be able to get one no matter what.
That's
because
correct.
You are in custody.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, I saw your note on the thing. That is correct. The idea is other forms of redress are available if you're in custody.
And we've got Mr. Van Volkenberg from the Department of Justice, who is counsel to the Department of Corrections, if we have questions about any of these issues. And we can. Do you have one?
I'm going to make a motion.
Okay. Well, I want to make sure we talk it through, that everybody's comfortable. Representative McPherson? You're fine. Anybody else?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
I'm just curious. In an earlier bill, and forgive me for not remembering whether it was today or yesterday, we had the issue about police officers in their or people in their normal duties being already exempted from certain statutes. Why wouldn't that apply here? And does that, I guess what I'm driving at is there really a need for this bill?
Well, Representative Crummell, I don't recall if you were here when we had the initial testimony on this bill in committee. But the issue has come that at least one judge felt, given the way the statute was written and the prima facie statements in the initial
temporary
stocking petition, that he was left with no choice but to issue the order. And so this is an attempt to deal with that issue so it can't be used as a tool to disrupt the management of these facilities by even if it's not going to stand up once you get to the full hearing, during the period of time that the temporary order is issued, they have to abide by the terms of the temporary order, which could be a real management problem within the institutions. And the reference that you've got that says that you're not subject to that statute doesn't apply to this particular case. And in fact, that's what we're sort of doing here, is we're carving this out and saying, in these circumstances, you can't get a stocking order if you are this kind of person and it's against these kind of people. So we're doing exactly what that, sort of what you're referencing, but particular to this issue. Representative Adams.
I think maybe Representative Cromwell's thinking about the situation under the Oregon Tort Claims Act. The individual state employees are exempt from liability, but their entity is not. But since this does not involve a claim for damages, an individual employee could be subject to a restraining order or an injunction.
Thank you.
Okay. Are we set? Representative Pozanski?
Move the dash 6 in the House Bill 2177.
Representative Pozanski moves the dash 6 as to House Bill 2177. Is there further discussion on the motion? Objection. They're in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd now move, as amended, 2177 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Pozanski moves House Bill 2177 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Okay, Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Eric
Parker? Aye.
Jensen?
Yes.
Cromwell?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Pozanski?
Aye.
Shetterly?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2177 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who's feeling lonely? Who hasn't got a bill assignment?
I'd like to carry this.
Would you like to carry this one, yeah. Jeff? Okay. Representative Barker, then I'll carry this bill to the floor. And we are adjourned for the afternoon, committee. Thank you.